On Thursday, we're standing in the paddock and all the F1 drivers are driving their streetcars into the track and we're watching them all come in. Villeneuve comes in driving a Fiat and he comes into the parking lot sideways, drives in, drives it and parks it on a sidewalk and gets out of the car and walks in. Gilles comes out of pit lane sideways with his foot just down the hill, turn the next corner, sideways out of there. And we're just like, the crowd goes wild and they start cheering for him because that's what they want to see. Gilles, you know, wasn't his intent, but he was a great entertainer as well. And I think that's one of the reasons people love him.
I don't think I could come up with two setups on the same car that were so different that one would be 9 seconds better than the other in the wet.
Jeff is in fact lying. He's very good. He could find you 30 seconds. He could find you 3 hours. Just call him. He's very reasonably priced.
You've now made my spend of money for you being my agent worth it.
Welcome to It's Not the Car. I'm Sam Smith. I'm a journalist, I'm a club racer, and I'm in the final throes of publishing a collection of my writing about cars over the last 20 years. It's due in April. Jeff, who are you?
I'm Jeff Brown, oftentimes a bus driver, but not driving a bus today. I'm at home and working on some race engineering projects, which is my normal day job.
Excellent. Ross, who are you? Go.
And I'm Ross Bentley. I once dreamt of racing in Formula One. Obviously didn't make it. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be on this podcast with you guys.
No, but, you would.
You know, I dreamed of racing Formula One and didn't make it. So I went off and raced some other things. And then I got into driver coaching. And I am super excited about talking about today's topic on one hand. And the other hand, I actually don't want to talk about it. Weird.
Why? Wait, why? It has to do with Canada. Why don't you want to talk about Canada? You're from Canada.
I want to talk about Canada, and I want to talk about someone from Canada. But on the other hand, I don't, because I miss him.
Oh. Well, I think we all miss him. So on that note, we should probably get to it. So today, well, let's back up. We switch formats on this show every episode, partly to keep things interesting and partly because I have the attention span of a small rodent. This one, this episode, is what we call our monthly centerpiece episode. It's where we pull apart an epic racing story from the past. And today, we're going to talk about a man from Canada, a guy named Gilles Villeneuve. Did I pronounce that right, Ross?
Gilles Villeneuve, yes.
Gilles Villeneuve. And what he did in practice, what that man did in practice during the 1979 United States Formula One Grand Prix East at Watkins Glen, which is a really long way of saying Formula One came to the United States. It had been coming to the United States for a long time. It had been coming to the United States to one place for a long time. And this happened there in New York, in upstate New York. We're going to do this particular episode a little bit differently. We're not talking about the whole race. Typically, we pull apart one larger moment. We're not even talking about a day. We're talking about a handful of laps. Time one guy, a French-Canadian that almost everybody loved, made an entire paddock and an entire racetrack, stopped what they were doing, and just dropped their jaws for a few laps. And coincidentally, this guy is one of my heroes. He's one of Ross's heroes. Jeff, is he one of your heroes? You're nodding.
Absolutely. I mean, definitely.
See, that's the thing, right? This guy, the way this dude worked, to the way he, even the picture, I have a book on my desk written by a guy named Gerald Donaldson, which I'll talk about later, but the picture on the cover is just his face, and he's got this kind of smirk, and he's got weird tussled hair, and he looks like one of those dudes that you're like, oh, I get that guy's a jerk, except he's not a jerk. There's this warmth in his eyes. He's one of those people that everybody in racing, once you learn the story, you think about it, and you think, oh, man, Gilles. So, on that note, the way we typically do these things is I jump into a bathtub of coffee and then I rattle off the story rapid fire and we spend the rest of the episode diving into the tale and kind of unpacking the cool bits. This story I love a bit too much, so I'm going to slow down just a little and tell a little bit more of it. Ross, Jeff, that worked for you?
Go for it.
I love it.
Okay. Hi, I'm Sam. We make this show because we like it, but also because it keeps our young producer, Mike, off the street and away from a life of crime. If you want to help both of those things happen, your luck. We have this thing called Patreon. For a few bucks a month, you get to help support the show, but you also get some neat perks like monthly bonus episodes. The money we raise through Patreon helps keep this show on the air. If you like what you're getting here and want to help us keep doing it, that'd be great. If not, that's fine too. We like you anyway. You're here. We're glad. Join at patreon.com/notthecar. Back to the show.
As Gilles would say, go for it.
Go for it. Before we get started, there's one caveat. There's one fact in here. It's the gap distance in lap time to the next person between Gilles and someone else in this practice session that we're talking about. And the record disagrees about it. Some pieces of information say 11 seconds. Some say it's 9.5. We're going to go with a more conservative estimate there. I won't bore you with why. If you want to know why, and I mean if you really want to know why, drop an email to intcpod@gmail.com and I will tell you. And I'll tell you. It's not complicated, just not for here. So, all right, you guys ready? We'll jump into this thing.
Go.
Okay, this entire thing hangs on a person, a Canadian person, which, as history has shown, means that he's statistically proven to be very okay with cold weather and also with being very nice to everybody. This guy was French-Canadian. He was born in Quebec in 1950. He's the son of a piano tuner. In 1979, year of our race, he is 29 years old, at the peak of his career, the prime of his life. He is driving for Ferrari in Formula One. It means exactly what you think it does. He raced only from 1977 to 1982. He spent 5 years in Formula One. He had 6 wins. That's it in that period. The closest he came to a championship was in 1979. Again, the year we're talking about, he came second. But that doesn't matter because he started racing in a way that kind of carved out how his whole head worked. Started in snowmobiles, which obviously run in the snow, and fast snowmobiles. So, you know, you get on the thing, you ride the thing, you go sideways in the thing, you fall off the machine at 100 miles an hour onto the ice a lot. But it made him money, it let him kept moving forward. He would say later that this was basically the point that made him stop worrying about cars moving around, about the rain, about anything that could ever happen in a race car, because how could it be any worse than falling off a snow machine in blinding snow when your fingers are frozen and you're sliding onto a big pile of ice at 100 miles an hour and maybe you nearly die? Well, it's not that. So he comes up in Formula Atlantic. It's then this latter series to Formula One. He wins 2 championships. And in 1976, in a Formula Atlantic race, he beats a guy named James Hunt. And it's that James Hunt. It's Formula One driver, English, playboy, dude that Chris Hemsworth played in the Ron Howard movie Rush. He beats a guy in that Formula Atlantic race. That guy is Hunt. Hunt is then driving in F1 for McLaren. That was the year that he won a championship. Hunt goes to McLaren. Hunt says, well, hey, how about this Canadian dude? Put him in a car. They do put him in a car. The last year's car at Silverstone this year. He qualifies 9th, finishes 2 laps down. He's in 11th. Everybody's like, yeah, okay, except there's a really cranky guy in Italy who notices. That guy is Enzo Ferrari. Enzo Ferrari puts him on a plane. He flies him to Italy. He signs him, based on the strength of that drive, to a ride in Formula One. He later says something like, some people called Villeneuve crazy. I said, eh, let's try him. Also, Enzo was a weird dude, but that's not important right now. Enzo puts Villeneuve in a car in 1977 for the last 2 races. He DNFs in both of them. He damages the car. Next year, 1978, up and down. Some people in the paddock call him a menace, says he doesn't think enough, but he wins once in Canada, in Montreal, 1979. 79 is the guy's year. It's the closest he comes to the championship. Again, second place. He wins the first 2 races out, and like the rest of the field, yeah, he has an uneven year because that year, Lotus came out with a car that changed everything. We'll probably do an episode on it at some point, but that's not the point right now. That car changed everything, was dominant, revolutionary, and everybody who would have been great that year was kind of relegated to trying for second. Through all of this, in those 2 short years in Formula One, he becomes known as a beast at the wheel. He's not always the fastest, but he's certainly always the quickest when things get weird. As a force of nature, he does not give up. He is known for this delicate feel and incredible car control and incredible bravery, hucking over curbs, driving long past the point of sanity, thrashing cars. He's chalked up as a wild talent, but he's ultimately smarter than that and more of a thinker, packaged in this romantic, just balls-out racer, charger, hero, madman. In 1979, I'm going to make a side story. I told Mike I wouldn't do this. 1979 at Zandvoort, tire comes apart like 48 laps into the race, throws the car off the road. Gilles stuck in the car. He sits there and hammers the starter, trying to get the car restarted. The Ferrari finally starts. He has almost a whole lap left to get back to the pits, but he keeps driving. Wheel comes off, tire falls off. He gets back into the pits. Car looks like a bomb goes off in it. It's clear to everybody that there's no way it's going back out. He doesn't get out of the car. He yells at the mechanics to reassemble it, put it back in one piece, get them going. It's not going to happen. That's Gilles in a nutshell. But 1979, we're talking about this, right? Watkins Glen. This is the first of two seasons he'd be teammate at Ferrari to a really talented, just legendary driver named Jody Scheckter. Now you have to remember what F1 was like at the time, right? 10 years before, the sport had been treaded tires and cars without wings and tracks that were basically designed to kill you. 10 years after that, it was the beginning of the end for small independent teams, the rise of so much analysis and so much data on the cars. But in this narrow window, things were changing fast. Things were moving fast. The tracks were still deadly. Schechter and Villeneuve are both in a car. They're in a Ferrari. It's called the 312 T4. It's this red and white shovel-nosed doorstop of a thing. It's based on the car that Ferrari had run in 1974. It was updated every year from 75 or so to 80. It's 1,300 pounds, has a 3-liter flat 12, makes more than 500 horse at 12,000 RPM. It's semi-monocoque, which means steel tubes, some aluminum, structures, stiffness. In the end, with the body off, it looks like a giant household HVAC unit that kind of got pregnant and, you know, mutant and weird. It does not sound like you think a V12 sounds. V12s, you know, typically think, whop, this sounds like, mwah. It has this nasally tenor raspy honk. It's not high-pitched. It just sounds mad in Italian. So the race, that weekend, Watkins Glen in 1979, the race is not important. What's important is what happened on Friday of that race weekend. Now, Watkins Glen, at the time, the track looked similar to today. It was 3.3 miles, 11 corners. It was fast. It was built in the hills in the 1950s after racing on the streets of the town of Watkins Glen became way too dangerous. Then, as now, it was this place where you take chances and you put everything you have on the table. There's big sweeping elevation change. And if you do not come to the Glen with everything you got, you are slow. Except one thing that made it different in that period is when it rained, like a lot of circuits in periods, it didn't drain for shit. The F1 circus rolls into town. It's 10 a.m. on a Friday. It's Friday practice. The place is nasty. It's raining. It's been raining for a while. It's a steady, cold, muddy, steady rain, cold, muddy day. Everyone's grumpy. It's the worst track conditions anyone can remember. It's kind of rain and the weird light you get in upstate New York, or even the top third of the Northern Hemisphere, anywhere in the world, right? Where the world seems darker and more gray than it really is. 30 cars are allowed to practice by the rules. 24 will qualify for the race. That first session, it's so nasty that only 18 go out. There are crashes, there's sheets of water running across the track. It's just a mess. Everybody's like, well, not do that. The next time session begins at 12:30. It is 90 minutes long. By this point, rain is just pouring. Everyone knows it's a waste of time. The track is quiet. One or two cars go out at a time. An Alpha goes out. A guy named Brembia does a 2-minute, 25-second lap, spins massively coming onto the pit straight, kicks the clutch in, keeps the engine going. Everybody cheers. He ends up in the middle of the track facing the right way. He goes back around, and they're like, okay, cool. Well, you know, maybe this can happen. Next time Brembia comes around, it's because he's going into the pits because he smeared the rear wing off the car, spun again, and like, oh, that wasn't going to last. There's water in the pit lane. Paper cups are floating by in rivers. Now, this is in a time in the sport when things weren't safe. And by weren't safe, I mean really weren't safe. People died so regularly that Sports Illustrated would regularly comment in its race reports as a matter of course that, oh, hey, there were no fatalities this time around. So in that light, the people who signed up to go do this sort of thing and people who made it to the top, they were all talented people. Not counting Schechter and Villeneuve, our two guys at Ferrari, it was a bunch of legends. There were names like Andretti and Ix and Fittipaldi and Reutemann and Rosberg and Regazzoni and Piquet and Jones and Patrese, and that's not even the whole field. Many of the rest of the field you would recognize, but between those nine people that I just listed, we need to take a moment for perspective, right? Those nine people, they had or would go on to have 91 Formula One poles, 290 Formula One podiums, 100 Formula One wins, 8 Formula One championships, 6 Le Mans wins, 5 IndyCar titles, and 1 Can-Am title. And this, by the way, is in my notes where I have the words written as a joke, or basically 1 Max Verstappen. Ha 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 ha. The point is, that's how bad the track was. That epic list of talent, it was raining so bad, it was such a nightmare that those people didn't want to go out. Partly because, you know, there was a good chance the rain was going to end before the race on Sunday, and it would certainly be brighter on Saturday, and everything was just risky. There was no reason to set a time now when the track was going to get faster. They calculated, they took a chance, then as now, that's how racing works. But the risk here, the risk, that was not what our boy Villeneuve thought about. Our boy, he thought about whether it was going to be a chance to take the car out and wring its fucking neck. So that practice session at 12:30. Reutemann goes out once, looks around, comes back in the pits, doesn't even set a time. Brembia, that that lap earlier, he's still pole at 2 minutes and 40 seconds. Now, keep in mind, the Glen is fast now. It's fast then. It was slightly faster then. The lap record at that point dated to 1978, the year before. Mario Andretti had set a 1:38. It was an average speed of 123.9 miles an hour. Again, Brambilla turned, what did I say? 2 minutes 40. So in the middle of all this, everything gets quiet. The rain keeps going. The track's quiet. And a helmeted man is in the paddock, except he's being carried. He's not walking. He's being carried by a large Italian broad-shouldered mechanic in red overalls. He's carried across all of those puddles because some of those puddles are pretty deep and he's got shoes. And who wants wet shoes when you're driving a race car? And after that, a Ferrari starts up. The helmeted man was dumped into the Ferrari. It's car 12. It goes splashing down pit lane all by itself and onto the track, and everyone takes notice because they know who's in it. It's Gilles. It's our boy. It's the maple bacon Quebecois stud. It is still pouring. Jacques Lafitte, one of the drivers on the grid, one of the greatest drivers on the grid, gets excited. He goes around his garage urging people to go out and watch. Everyone gathers on the fence. The teams move over. Journalists go to the corners. Even the most jaded people in the paddock, they stop what they're doing to hang on that fence because by this point, the dude has been in the series for 2 years. They know him. They know how he works. And they know that he just loves the wet. The first time out past the pits, turn one at Watkins Glen is this long downhill right-hander. It's off camber. It's fast. He's flying into it. He looks as fast as some people go through there in the dry. He's not, but he looks like it. He flies through the chicane sideways. There are four rooster tails coming off the car, one off each wheel, 10 or 15 feet in the air. He's flat out every single lap. People on the back straight, spectators talk about hearing wheel spin at the end of the back straight where the car was doing 150 miles an hour. And after a while, it's just him. He's just out there, lapping alone, lapping and lapping. And when the session is over, he had clicked off a 201. Now keep in mind, Brambilla did a 240, right? 2 minutes and 1 second. He's nearly 40 seconds faster than the pole so far. He averaged 100.11 miles an hour. Lafitte's standing on the fence, and he goes, look at him. Why do we even bother? He's different than the rest of us. He's on a separate level. And people start to think, okay, well, fine, sure. That's the kid. People can drive. Let's go out. Cars are sent out. Scheckter goes out in the other Ferrari. Ferrari's taking it very seriously. They're very organized. Alan Jones goes out into Williams. Frank Williams tells him just go as fast as he like. Jones comes back in, says he can't even give the car full throttle on the straights. He did a 237. Hans Stuck, touring car driver, sideways Stucky, known for a career in touring cars, sideways airborne stuff at the Nürburgring. He goes out in an ATS. He comes back in immediately, says it is impossible. Scheckter goes back into the paddock, stops and tries to tell the organizers to cancel practice because it's unsafe, but it doesn't matter. Our boy's still out there. Villeneuve's still driving, still lapping. And in the end, he is 9.652 seconds faster than Scheckter, the reigning world champion, in the same car, on the same tires, over 3.3 miles of track. Scheckter later said he was out there, holding on for dear life, and just admitted that he was scaring the nipples off himself. And he came in, he was like, well, certainly I must be the fastest. That was awful. It was terrible. It was one of the best, worst things I've ever done. And when he came in, he saw Gilles' time. His mind just went blank. He didn't understand how it was possible. Now, Gilles, this is why everybody loves him. He gets out of the car. He tells the reporter, that was fun. The reporter's like, well, how was it? He goes, well, I think I could have been quicker. I was flat in fifth on the straight, 160 miles an hour, but the engine had a misfire. It was down about 600 RPM from normal. And the exact quote, the quote that when I read it cracked my brain open was, but for that, I could have gone quite a bit faster. But maybe then I would have crashed. Keeps raining. It rains a bit during the race later that weekend. All you really need to know about the race is that Villeneuve, at the end, had failing oil pressure for like the last 25 laps. He nurses engine to the finish, tells a reporter that he nearly lost it on the first corner of the first lap, side by side with Alan Jones and that Williams. The reporter asks him how many other times that almost happened. And our boy, the Canadian, the former snowmobile racer, who all he wanted was to drive the wheels off anything, all he does is grin and say, I can't even, every lap. Now, Gilles was in Formula One for 3 more years. He died tragically in a 140-mile-an-hour crash at the 82 Belgian Grand Prix. His death is one of the most just gutting moments in the history of the sport. just this bright light snuffed in his prime. But we have that moment, this reminder that the people who make a dent in this world, so often they make that dent not for what they do, but for how they do it. Right?
Yeah.
Yes. Man, that's a great story.
It's yeah. so good. I read it in countless places, like 5, 10, 15 times. Never got old. Just never got old. What does any of that mean to either one of you, really?
Can I start by let me get the ugly stuff out of the way.
Yeah.
As I said, I was dreaming of following Jill. I was going to go to Formula One. There was a magazine in Canada, Autosport Canada, that every year would rank the next generation of the next Jill. And, you know, I remember getting on that list and going, yes, I'm going to make it. And in 82, I was racing Formula Atlantic for a extremely small team, which was basically the team owner and me, and my brother sometimes, who built his own car. So I remember that Saturday morning in my little garage building bodywork for the Formula Atlantic car and listening to reports about the qualifying at the Belgian Grand Prix, and news about Gilles' crash came on. And I just stopped. I dropped my tools. I kind of just sat there, and I sat on the floor in the garage. And there is nobody that I've ever felt this way for. But like, I just went, why? Like, I can't take this. And I came really close to going, that's it, I'm done.
Really?
Yeah. I can remember years later reading about Jill's crash and everything. And I think it was Eddie Cheever, actually, who was racing in F1 at the time, went on to win Indy 500, a little race in Indiana. And I think Cheever said something like, you know, we all, after Jill's crash, we all wanted to stop. Like, we didn't want to. But he says, Jill would not have wanted that. And in fact, he actually said something along the lines of, while Jill's car was flying through the air and tumbling and cartwheeling and ripping apart, and his body was being ripped apart, Jill was probably thinking, man, I could have taken that faster. And yeah, so I guess, yeah. I carried on.
Well, what is it about? So, I mean, this is not to take this in this direction for that long, because part of what's so remarkable when we start unpacking why we miss somebody or why somebody's exit hits us. What was it about him being alive that and the way he went through the sport that you had chosen? What was it about that made you feel so strongly? Why did he hit you? It wasn't just Canada. It wasn't just because racing driver. It was.
No, it wasn't just because he was a fellow Canadian, but, you know, a bit like Senna. You know, Senna raced passionately.
Yeah.
But I'd have to say that Gilles made Ayrton Senna look kind of dull and boring. You know, like he drove with, I don't know, Sam, you're the word guy. What's passion times 1,000? Like that's why the world to this day loves him. That is why if you go to Monza today, you know, there's no statues of Italian drivers, but there is of a French Canadian. There is a Gilles Villeneuve museum at Monza. Like, he just is loved because of the way he drove. And you know, to be honest, I never wanted to race like him. Like, that's not my style. You know, I always kind of thought of, you know, I'd be more like Jackie Stewart, a thinking driver. You know, that's what I wanted to be. But Villeneuve inspired people. He made people go, oh, you know, I want to do something like that. Like that, I think that's what made him special. And yeah, that day at Watkins Glen, he inspired other Formula One drivers. Well, I think it inspired some Formula One drivers to go, why bother? As Lafitte said, he's different. He's not one of us kind of thing. You know, so I think he, you know, when we see any athlete, anybody, you know, we see a musician do something just incredible, we go, wow, look what we as humans are capable of. And Gilles did that lap after lap, like every lap, and also took don't ever quit to another level as well. Your example of the tire coming off the car, like, you know, yeah. I mean, he's famous for that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think he just inspired, he motivated, he made us think what's possible.
Jeff, how did the guy hit you? And more important, you've been smiling this whole time. We're talking about a handful of laps, and we're talking about a handful of laps. Like the next day, everybody went out. You know, the actual qualifying times for the race weren't set in that session. It didn't matter. Why does something like that hit you? I mean, what part of that turns your engineer brain off and just makes you just glow? Why?
Do I have to talk? Can I just keep listening? Because this is a great, this is a great story. I mean, and I lived through that. I saw all of this. I was a Formula One fan at that time and everything. But just listening to you two guys talk about this, to me, it's that intangible kind of thing that we probably can't define, but it's Gilles was cool. And people like cool guys, right? Whether you are a fan of his or not, you know, Dale Earnhardt was cool. You know, Don Prudhomme, the Snake, cool. Gilles Villeneuve, cool. He had that kind of aura around him, you know. He went to the races in a motorhome with his family and he was just a guy, but he was not a guy once he got in that car. And he had that coolness factor, a James Hunt kind of coolness to him, but in a different way. And so I think that's why people loved him and loved to watch him and see what he could do. And there was, you never knew what kind of amazing performance you were going to get. You knew it was going to be an amazing performance, but you didn't know how it would play out. The tire could be coming off. There's iconic pictures of him sideways on some street course with the tire against the wall, and he's like 45 degrees to the track. There's, you know, the famous Dijon race with René Arnoux. It was always going to be amazing, but you never knew how it was going to play out. And so people just loved watching him. And you know, like you said, Sam, in those days, the drivers that he was up against were amazing, and he could beat them on a regular basis. But, and maybe that's wrong, he could beat them when they shouldn't have gotten beaten.
Right, right.
And that's the key. You know, like this guy is on it. He's unbeatable today, except, what this Villeneuve dude beat him on that day? Impossible. But he could pull that off.
So part of that, you mentioned cool, right? You know, the idea of, I think we're drawn to two things with certain people. We're drawn to the notion of effortlessness, you know, because nobody on some level, everybody knows what it's like to feel uncomfortable in your own skin. And when we think about people where their attitude is something that we're drawn to and something that we find appealing, it's typically the idea of they seem to make being a human effortless, look effortless, even if it's not. And that's crossed, for me, that's crossed with, you know, the element of something is happening here that shouldn't be possible, that can't be explained, that I don't understand how he connects A to B. I can see the light at the end of the tunnel for driver A, driver B, driver C. I can see how they get there. It's just work and time. But driver D, there's some, and it's that Senna effect, right? That, you know, Senna used to talk about going to that strange otherworldly place and tapping into the voice of God and all these other things. And in the end, it really just comes down to weaponized flow state and that weird fuzzy logic of that person does a thing that I didn't know was possible. Jeff, how often do you see in modern motorsport a driver, because it's so different on so many levels, how often do you see a driver pull that sort of thing off or step outside that bubble in something, in a situation where you look at the numbers, you look at the data, you look at the car, you look at the specifics of the moment, and it doesn't seem possible? Does it even happen?
Wow. You, when you started asking that question, I started to have to think. I was like, oh, gee, I got to have an answer.
But
I
got to
come up
though.
With one of these times that it's happened that I know about, and I'm struggling to find those things. I mean, that's why Villeneuve is still to this day. It's why we're talking about him, right? Because if there were people that came along that could do that every 3 or 4 years, he would be just one of those guys that could do that every 3 or 4 years. But man, it just doesn't happen. I mean, no, I don't really know. I mean, who goes out and is 9-point-something seconds faster than the best drivers in the world? Okay, you put the top Formula One, Verstappen in a car against club racers in the rain, it's going to be that much faster. You put him against all the other Formula One drivers in the rain, nah, he's not going to be 9 seconds faster. Not happening. And so, and it wasn't like those guys weren't trying. And they, you know, they're as competitive as it gets. And they're out there going, okay, Watkins Glen, okay, if he can do it, I can do it. I'm going to go out and I'll be as fast as him or close or maybe even faster. And they couldn't even come close. And so if you can impress the best drivers in the world with your performance, man, that does not happen. I don't know that it's happened lately.
The funny thing about this is that it's such an epic kind of pivotal moment in the sport that you can Google it now and people are still talking about it on forums, in as much as anybody uses the forum anymore. But there are still like threads on the Autosport forums, people talking about this. And I dug up one a couple of days ago. So somebody had retold their story of sitting trackside and watching this happening and just like talked about, you know, it, hearing nothing. And then Ferrari flat 12 and seeing the wheel spin and just, you know, guys standing knee deep in mud at the side of the track at the Glen with like two beers in their hand and their jaws on the floor. But one person responded to the whole tale and just kind of said something like, you know, from all the accounts I've read of this incident, it seems like a case of Villeneuve's courage more than skill, right? If everybody else had gone out and really pushed it, the gap would have been less. And, you know, there are 1,000 other caveats, right? You know, there were two main tire suppliers at that point, and one of them was really good in deep water, and one of them was good in intermediate. And the more you listen to that stuff, the more you read it, the more you think, well, okay, sure. And yet that doesn't explain the difference between Schechter and Villeneuve in the same car. Doesn't explain 9 seconds. It doesn't, and even if it does, even if you look at it and you're like, okay, well, it was just equipment, and Schechter went out and tried at 70%, and Villeneuve tried at 120%. You look at it and you think, okay, well, the fact that the guy was willing, and this is not how it worked, right? But the fact that the dude was willing to do it when no one else was, when nothing was on the line, is remarkable, right? I love that you can pull it down to the most pessimistic, cynical worldview, and it's still this wonderful little ball of light story. It just hits me, you know?
I think, Sam, you nailed it there in that he did it for the love of driving that lap. And I think Schechter said that Villeneuve races to win the laps. Like he wants to win that lap and then the next lap and the next. He didn't care about the race or the championship or anything else. But I think that's it. He did it for the pure love and enjoyment of being the fastest. And it didn't matter whether it was Friday session in the rain, in the dry, you know, with three wheels or four wheels. Like it didn't matter to him. My best friend and I, in 1979, we drove from Vancouver down to Long Beach to see the U.S. Grand Prix West at Long Beach. And this was our chance to see Gilles in a Formula One car. And I remember two things that pop into my mind about that. First off is sort of a little bit more about him as a person outside of the race car. Yeah. Was on Thursday, we're standing in the paddock and all the F1 drivers are driving their rental cars or their cars, their street cars into the track. And we're watching them all come in and, you know, they all sort of come in and they park in here. Villeneuve comes in driving a Fiat that has been given to him. And he comes into the parking lot sideways, drives it and parks it on a sidewalk and gets out of the car and walks in. And we're like we're just killing ourselves laughing, watching this thing. But then like the very first practice session, Friday morning, my friend Ron and I were standing there and sort of near pit exit. And that was when they sort of dropped down the hill right then. And all the drivers had come out first session, you know, the track's dirty. It's a street course. And they're all coming out and kind of coming out and kind of gradually working up to speed over two or three, five, six laps or something. Gilles comes out of pit lane sideways with his foot just down the hill, turn the next corner, sideways out of there. And we're just like, everybody, the crowd goes wild and they start cheering for him because that's what they want to see. They don't want to see a bunch of race drivers come out and gradually warm up to speed. Gilles, it wasn't his intent, but he was a great entertainer as well. And I think that's one of the reasons people love him.
Okay, so from a coaching standpoint, you've spent an entire career watching people try to achieve, right? And what I find really, really, really deeply interesting about that is that everybody does it differently, but they're all working toward the same goal, right? So that raises the question, does it matter? Have you seen it matter more accurately? If you're in the car and you're trying to reach whatever the hell that 11th tenth is, does it matter if you love it? Does it matter if you can't get enough of it and can't stop? Or is that just...
Absolutely.
Why? What does it change? What does it change?
I remember a quote from Bobby Unser, Indy 500 winner,
Uncle Bobby,
saying that what makes the difference is desire. And if you don't absolutely, totally love what you're doing, that desire, that commitment, that ability to push and just I'm going to perform magic, isn't there. So the love has to be there. And, there are drivers who just sometimes they seem to be just kind of showing up and doing their job. And there are others that they don't care if they get paid or don't get paid or, what happens. They just want to drive. And yep. That makes a huge difference. It's that desire that I'm just gonna go and, it's pouring rain. Everybody else is sitting in the pits because they're afraid to go out. I'm gonna go play. And I think that's what Gilles, everything to him was play. It was just playtime.
I think the analogy that I can make is, I'm sure a lot of people have seen the movie Free Solo with Alex Honnold.
Oh man.
Alex Honnold. Yeah. Climbs mountains, rock climbs for him, for his enjoyment, for his desire. He doesn't do it to put on a show. He doesn't do it to impress others. He doesn't do it for any other reason than he just loves doing that more than anything else. To me, Villeneuve was the same way. He went out at Watkins Glen not to say, I'm gonna blow away these other Formula One drivers with my skill. That never entered his mind, I'm sure. He just wanted to go drive his race car as fast as he could in those conditions, in any condition, whether it's Long Beach on the first day of the weekend when there's still dust and oil and radiator fluid from the streetcars that have been put down for 365 days a year. He doesn't care. Here's the conditions. I'm going out to drive this car because I love driving this race car. Not because Mr. Ferrari told me to, or because they pay me this much, or there's a bunch of fans expecting me to be sideways and they're going to clap for me. He would do that like Alex Honnold does it with no spectators around, my opinion.
And Jeff, you make a good point about Honnold. There's a lot of people that after watching that movie Free Solo, which you watch with sweaty palms, it's scary to watch, right?
I watch from behind the couch because it sets off every ounce of vertigo I've got.
Yeah. And you watch it and you go, and they kind of allude to this in that movie where, maybe Honnold's missing that little fear thing in your brain, that little synapse that makes us go, don't do that. That's scary.
Right.
But I think if you look at how he did things, he prepped better than anybody else. And that's how he dealt with that. Villeneuve was always accused of being braver than he should be. And maybe there was some of that. There was a thing about in testing or in a race or a practice session. I think it was at Imola in 81 or something like that. He crashed at that Tamburella corner, that big fast corner, the one that Senna died at, right? Yep. And he had this massive crash. And they had a heart rate monitor on him, and his heart rate, hitting the wall, the car exploding, 180 miles an hour or something like this, and his heart rate went up three clicks. Like, so, you know, I think it kind of goes back a little bit to what you were talking about at the very beginning, Sam, of him driving snowmobiles. You're blind, you're the thing's moving around all over the place. He crashed a lot. You know, for him, it was just, yeah, it was another day in the office. And I think it's sort of, but he was prepared for that. So I'm not convinced that there was some fear synapse that was missing in his brain like it is with Honnold. I think it's just what they got used to and their comfort level of, this is what, you know, this is what you do. You know, you reach across to hopefully grab that crack in the side of El Capitan and while you're climbing that thing. Or, right. You know, you hold it flat through that corner and go, I'll deal with it later.
Right.
That's what Gilles did in the car.
Have either one of you ever seen any moments or met anyone who is not necessarily paid the price, but seen any instances where having that lack of sense of consequence, that lack of fear, makes a person worse at what they're trying to do, where you get into the car and you think, screw it, I'm going to huck it into turn one flat and it doesn't matter, like whatever comes out the other side, and that doesn't go well, and then they can't shed that piece of kind of obstinate bravery? Like, have you seen any moments where it pays off the other way? Because we always talk about how, like, well, you know, he was very brave and he hung off the side of mountain in turn one with 3,000 horsepower and Can-Am, blah, blah, blah. But, like, we don't talk about the fact that it's just as hard to ditch the kind of unthinking bravery if it's knee-jerk for you as it is to try and gain it if you don't have it, right?
So, Jeff, I want to throw this to you in a second here about some of the drivers that you've worked with at Indy.
Oh, man.
And, you know, there's a place where bravery will make you fast up to a certain point, and then you spend time in the hospital at best. And so yes, but I think, you know, the best are capable of sort of dialing that up for a little bit and then dialing it back. And, you know, I think of Rick Mears. There was a thinking driver who, you know, was always so precise and thinking and everything, until there came a time where it was just like, send it. And, you know, he made that amazing pass around Michael Andretti at Indy that year, doing that, like where he just got really brave, but then was able to dial that back down when he needed to. Jeff, you've seen and worked with drivers at Indy who dial it up and don't know when to dial it back.
And I think that's, I think, that's the key word you said, Ross, is that preparation, right? I mean, I think it gives them confidence if they're prepared and they know what they're doing and they know what they're up against and they study. Suddenly, Rick Mears looks really brave, but maybe he's brave, you know, the bravery, the ballsiness, the, you know, crazy, I'm just going to go for it here. Maybe he pulls that off because he's so well prepared that he knows what the windsock looked like going into turn one. So it looks brave, but Mears might tell you, no, there was no risk there at all. Because I knew what I was getting into. I was prepared. I was confident. And so I think sometimes we attribute bravery to something that could be better attributed to preparedness. I've seen drivers who haven't been as prepared and had to be brave out of desperation. Indy, that happens a lot at Indy. 33 spots. You're going to not make the Indy 500 unless you're at least 33rd, and there's 40 guys going for it. And man, to not make the Indy 500 puts, if you're on that bubble, puts you in desperation mode. And some drivers just say, well, I'll just be braver. Instead of, I'll study harder, I'll figure it out, and then I'll go quicker. I'll just be braver. I'll just go flat in turn one, even though I probably can't. I'll just try it. And boom, they crash.
I think
that's not bravery to me. That's just dumb.
Well, that's really interesting, right? Because the nature of bravery, I think, in itself comes down to knowing the consequences, knowing how badly things could go, taking an educated guess as to where you need to be, and then going out and trying it anyway, in spite of what could go wrong. And the, you know, the Jackie Stewart, famously Formula One driver, sports car driver, but famously campaigned in the late 60s and late 70s and for all of his life, really, to make the sport safer. And, you know, he talks in his books, he's, you know, all his speaking engagements, he's said for years that the strangest part about it was that he was trying to save the lives of literally everyone in the paddock at a time when the sport at its highest level, ostensibly its most evolved level, you know, in Formula One, was killing a handful of people every year, and everybody wrote it off as being okay, right? But he talks about how people pushed back against it and drivers pushed back against it because they felt that it was just necessary and it was all they knew and they hadn't known anything safer. And, you know, you think about that and you think about the fact that, like, now everyone expects it to be the sport to be relatively safe and the cars to be relatively safe and the tracks to be relatively safe and all of that to add up to a certain amount of agreed risk. And yet there are, I think all of us, we know drivers that if all of that risk were, you know, elevated back to where it was, all of Stewart's achievements, all the changes in track safety and in car safety and in safety gear, all of it were wiped away tomorrow. I think all of us know drivers that would still get back in the car, that would get back in a 70s Ferrari F1 car, in a 312, or in a Can-Am car, or in a 1920s Miller, whatever the hell it was, because they can't get enough and because they need it. And there are people, and I don't think you can blame them in the slightest for this, but there are people by the same token who are at the top level of the sport who would hang it up and go, no, this is not for me. But it's that notion of it being this kind of fungible but floating point thing where, you know, you can be what is brave in one circumstance is merely stupid in another. You were talking about bravery at Indy, Jeff. What, and Ross, you too, like this, you know, when I think of that, I think, okay, well, you know, the car's loose and there's crosswinds and it's trimmed out and everything's a nightmare and I think it'll do it, but I have to do it. Is there something more to it? How does that work when you ask a driver to be brave?
That's a really good question. And I want to kind of take that and ask Ross this, because I've seen this happen, but I can't explain how it happens. To me, that bravery that you just talked about, Sam, you know, where they just like, I'm just going to go do it at Indy or any place. The guys that pull that off, that just like, I'm just going to go here and carry an extra 1 mile an hour because I know that's what I need. If it doesn't work, if they get in the corner and they're like, oh, geez, they can recover from that. They have the skills somehow to be able to say, oh, I got in too deep, and they come out the other side slower. They blow that corner or that lap, but they don't crash. Other drivers get in there 1 mile an hour too fast and just don't have the skills and they hit the wall. And so the guys that are super fast have a skill that allows them to try to go quicker. And if it works, they're amazingly quick and people are like, oh my God, how did he do that? And if it doesn't work, they blow that lap, but they get another lap. They don't crash. To me, Ross, I've always wondered, how do you learn that? Because you have to overdrive the car to, like Villeneuve clearly did so often, sideways with the tire against the wall is not fast. But he could do that for one lap and go, oop, that's too much, and back it off. Where the other guys just smoked the car into the wall and the session was over and they weren't fast because they never got another chance at it. How do you learn that skill, Ross? Because you have to crash a lot of cars, or I don't know how did he figure that out?
So I mean, experience, like, just go do it. Right now, the problem with our sport is it's not easy to just, oh, I'll just go and take the race car out today and go and do 1,000 laps. You can't do that. You know, you can go, if you're a golfer, you can go to the driving range and hit balls all day long. Right. You can't do that in our sport, but I'm going to say the best drivers have this ability to put in their mind what it is they're going to do. And they practiced it in their mind, going back to the preparation piece. I think that's a big, big part of it. I think, you know, life experience has played a huge role in this. And, you know, so a guy like Villeneuve blasting around in the snow in a snowmobile, he was prepared for that. And so I think the best drivers are, they just have more experience, but you nailed it with the the best drivers get into a corner and they throw it in there and they go, I got it. I can deal with this.
Right.
And the less than best throw it in there and go, oh my God, now I'm in trouble. I don't know what to do. And I crash.
Right.
And I think that was the difference between Villeneuve is, you know, he's out there that day in the rain and he just throws in the corner going, I'll deal with it. You know, yeah, I got wheel spin at the end of the back straight. I'll deal with it. Whereas others are like, I don't know how to deal with this. So I think that was a big part of it. And you know, if you don't mind, I'm going to throw it back to you, Jeff, and go, take a wild guess at the tire temperatures on Villeneuve's Ferrari versus Schechter's Ferrari. With Villeneuve out there tossing the car around, sliding it around, do you think that his tire pressures were a little higher and therefore he actually had more grip? And maybe even that aero was pushing the car into the ground a little bit more.
Yep. Yep. I mean, those factors are all part of it. And it's what we've always come back to, right, Ross? You got to drive it at the limit of the four tires. He, in the dry or the wet, could feel that limit at an amazing level. And all the other drivers are trying to do the same thing, but they're actually under driving the car. By definition, Schechter underdrove the car by 9 seconds a lap, underdrove the car. So yeah. He underdrove it a lot. And this is like the world champion. And that's what I was going to ask you, Ross, how could you, for instance, I could never set up a car that was 9 seconds better than the same. I don't think I could come up with two setups on the same car that were so different that one would be 9 seconds better than the other in the wet.
For all those listening right now looking to hire a race engineer, Jeff is in fact lying. He's very good. He could find you 30 seconds. He could find you 3 hours. Just call him. He's very reasonably priced. Never admit defeat, Jeff.
Thanks, Sam. That was, well, you've now made my spend of money for you being my agent worth it.
So Jeff, I as you were talking there, one of the things that I'm reminded of is a lot of drivers go into a corner and go, I predict that the car is going to slide. I think the very, very best go into a corner and go, I'll deal with what I've got.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm not going to
predict it. And Villeneuve just went in, and I'm pretty sure Schechter was out there going, you know, if I go a little faster here, the car's going to slide off the track. Now, you know, this is world champion. So it's not like, you know, oh my God, I'm really scared of this thing. No, but I think in his mind, in those conditions, he's predicting what might happen. Villeneuve didn't do that. He just went in there and then he dealt with it. And I think, you know, he pretty much lived his life that way. I mean, you know, one of the things that, you know, I never met Gilles. I got to see him in a Formula Atlantic car in 76 at my hometown track at Westwood. And Jeff, you were there. We never saw each other. I don't know how, but a couple little skinny teenagers running around then probably. So but everything anybody who ever talked about Gilles was said, one of the things that made Gilles so cool was he was honest. He was genuine. I think Schechter was one who said he was the most genuine person I ever met in my life. Everything he did was pure. You know, he just did the, I love the story about, and this is something that's kind of, all us Canadians know this story. Every Canadian gets this story. Going through elementary school, we hear about Gilles.
Part of history.
Where, you know, in his early days of racing, he didn't have any money, so and he needed tools. So he would go to Canadian Tire, and he would steal some tools. Well, late in his career, I think a year or two before he was killed, he went to his manager and said, write a check for $4,000 and give it to Canadian Tire. Because years ago, I stole some tools from them. I want to pay them back.
Hold on. I've never heard that. This is amazing. Seriously?
Seriously.
You're kidding.
Seriously. And that's the kind of person he was. He was like, That's the right thing to do. I did some bad things. I gotta make up for it now that I'm in a position where I can do that.
Wow.
So, you know, and you know, the whole thing of him dying that day at Zolder, you know, it came just after the race at Imola, when his teammate Didier Pironi passed him when he should not have been passed, and they had team orders, and Pironi didn't live up to the team orders, and Villeneuve just went, that's just not right. And, you know, in 79, when he was driving with Scheckter, I forget which race it was, but, you know, I can remember at that time, me and my friends, we would get together every time there was a Formula One race on CBC, we'd watch that race. And, you know, so I can remember that day watching Villeneuve catch Scheckter and then stay right on his tail to the very end of the race, because Scheckter, even though there was an understanding between Scheckter and Villeneuve that Scheckter was going to win that race because at that moment in time he was in the lead, Villeneuve could have driven around him, but that was who he was. I'd say an honorable man. Like, he was just like, That's what I agreed to. I'm going to do it. And that's what I think upset Villeneuve so much after that Imola race, and then leading into him trying to go for it so badly at Zolder.
I think there are, you know, the book has some really, really neat moments in it. But one of the things that I noticed is this common thread through it was there were so many little instances that illustrate that, right? There were so many instances that illustrate how this person who got into a sport where in order to be extremely good at it, you have to commit some level of hurt on everybody else, right? You have to have some large amount of ego, and you have to go into it knowing that you're willing to put everybody else behind you in order to achieve. And yet every time the guy had a chance to be human, every time he had a chance to be passionate or empathic, it happened, and he did that. And there was this sweet, childlike innocence about so much of what he did. Ross, listening to you guys talk about this and just thinking back on the book and thinking back on all the things that people said about him, and the idea that, you know, nobody sits there and talks about how many poles anybody lands, or how many, you know, so-and-so had 3,001 wins and yada, 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 Grand Prix wins. And that's fine, but that's baseball stats. We don't remember in any sport. We don't remember the people who notched the numbers. We remember the people who notched the numbers while being deeply human and being memorable in that way. And I, you know, there's listening to you talk about how you work in a car and how you think about like slides, right? I remember early on when I first started club racing, every time the car would go loose, you know, I was in my early 20s and I was scared shitless, and my body would go rigid and I'd huck the car off the track if the car slid for any reason. And there was this wake up moment where I realized that if I just relaxed and kept my eyes up and reacted to it, you know, I've been driving in snow for years and thought, okay, well, this has to be similar. And all of a sudden, just thinking not about what was about to happen, but trying to be in the moment and look forward and keep moving. There are 1,000 hackneyed Hallmark metaphors for how that's how life works, but these big, broader lessons in the guy's whole life and career where, like, if you're not doing something for love and it's consuming every bit of you, stop doing it. You know, if you're not in the moment with something, what the hell are you doing? And the only way to try is to be honest with yourself. Like, it's kindergarten stuff, but it's so hard to remember. I can't imagine what it's like, you know, trying to keep that in your head at, you know, $1.60 in the rain at the Glen, or ripping around Indy in a car that won't stay put, or any of it. I mean, how, if you could, I think it's fair to say that we don't see people like this that often. We've been talking about this constantly, but if you could pull it down, it's a handful of people over the last 50 or 60 years that have pushed the same buttons. What, 5, 10? You know, can you guys think of anybody else off the top of your head that makes you, Ross, I know Jim Clark hits you the same way. Jeff, anybody else?
Jim Clark, for sure. And, you know, I had a guy kind of a similar, you know, in that Jim Clark era, the Gilles Villeneuve of the Jim Clark era was Jochen Rindt. Who was that same kind of guy, just blindingly fast. Wasn't going to be as consistent as a Clark or a Graham Hill or Jackie Stewart in those days, but was so fast that people just went, holy smokes, that is incredible. And similar kind of personality, aura, coolness factor. But what amazes me is a guy like Villeneuve, you know, you talked about, what was it, 78. Here he is. Here he goes to the Trois-Rivières Formula Atlantic race, and James Hunt, the Formula One world champion, is there. That race attracted Formula One drivers year after year after year after year, and the Formula Atlantic guys who were on their way up got a chance to race against those guys. And then Villeneuve, I'm pretty sure, Ross, right? He used to come back after running Formula One and come back and still run that race.
I think he did once, I think, but I'm not sure whether his Ferrari contract allowed him to.
But
I mean, that was that is still an amazing, one of the coolest race events in North America, if not the world.
And for sure.
Yeah, for those years, I mean, and you got to remember, like, in that period of time in Formula Atlantic, when Villeneuve was coming up in that, you know, he was racing against Keke Rosberg, who became a world champion, Bobby Rahal, Danny Sullivan, Bob Earl, Tom Gloy, Price Cobb. I mean, all these guys that, you know, are. And so I have to stop. I got to tell the story of the 76 Formula Atlantic race at Westwood. And again, me and my buddy were at the far end of the track, down at the hairpin corner, long back straightaway, comes down into a hairpin. And at that time, Formula Atlantic had standing starts. So we hear all the cars up on the start line, and it's pouring rain. We hear this, wah, 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 all these, you know, 30 Formula Atlantic cars all revving their engine up, and then and they take off. And all of a sudden, we're standing there, and Villeneuve comes over the top of the hill, down the back straight, into the hairpin, and he's all by himself. And we're like, where is everybody? And then they come around. Like, he's got a 50-car length lead, half a lap into the race. And he just went on, just destroyed everybody. And, you know, I have all these stories about Villeneuve doing that kind of stuff. But, I think, Jeff, it's those, the drivers who do special things. Jochen Rindt. And to Sam's point, I think some of it is, but they were also very human. And I'm not going to say that, you know, Sam, you touched on the selfish part of it. And I agree 1,000% that, you know, to be at that level, you need to have a certain level of selfishness and ego, and you need to manage all those things. But you know, how many great race drivers were kind of, I'm not going to say broken people, but there was a side of them that was not...
So many.
That was just different.
Yep. So,
and maybe Villeneuve,
so
part of his difference was he was incredibly honest. And that actually led to his downfall, I think. He was also stupidly crazy. You know, there are stories about him, because he bought a helicopter. There are stories of him doing things in his helicopter that were just... Dude, that is wrong. You're putting other people's lives at stake here.
I don't mean to laugh. It's just like...
But it's just... So he was broken in some ways.
Yeah.
And I think, you know...
Well, it's...
Was Senna a little bit broken, you know?
Yeah, all
was Schumacher
them.
A little bit... Was, you know, like, they're all just... broken's the wrong word, but different.
Off the standard continuum, right? What were you saying, Jeff?
I was going to say, yeah, off the standard continuum, right? What you just said. I mean, think about the people that we revere, and some people don't revere them, but even business people, you know, a Elon Musk, a Steve Jobs, they were a little off too, but
yeah,
brilliant, and brought us, whether you like them, hate them, whatever, tremendous enjoyment to watch. You said it at the very start, Sam. Humans like to watch humans do things. And when you get the very best humans doing something, business or sport, whatever, all against each other, they all look kind of the same because they're all the best. And so you're like, wow, they're the best. But then when somebody like a Villeneuve stands out among the very best, we go, wow, we never thought that was possible. Those other 40 guys all are CEOs of great businesses. But then there's Steve Jobs and Elon Musk, where you go, wow, that is just different among the best in the world. And that was Villeneuve, which is, man, it's just so cool to see that.
How many brilliant musicians all died when they were 27 years old?
Right. Right.
I mean, ironically, Villeneuve's famous for being number 27.
27.
You know, that there's that we're about out of time, but there are a couple of things that I think are worth hitting on before we wrap this. My friend Ben Tongsai has this thing he always says that, you know, everybody gets one superpower, right? And I've thought a lot about that over the years, because when you meet somebody, you start learning what they're good at and bad at, and then you start to see how they've used their talents and used their skills, and those two things, realize that those two things are different. And some people, that superpower is very narrow and focused. And in some cases, that's because they've taken the time to focus it, or because they were just naturally born that focused, or a thousand things. And in some people, it's broad and multifaceted. And you look at somebody like Gilles, you know, Senna was an example, I think, of a very focused, narrow version of that. And Gilles was an example of a very broad and open version of that. And there's three quotes I want to wrap this on. It comes from a journalist, comes from Lafitte, and Jacques Lafitte, one of the other drivers at the time. And then from, I mean, we're talking about broken, not broken, we're talking about non-typical people, from Enzo Ferrari, from his book. Nigel Roebuck, journalist, said at one point, the crowds loved him because of all the drivers out there. He was the one so clearly working without a net, right? And Jeff, you alluded to this, the notion that we all have the same basic equipment. We all have bones and skin and brain and feet and hands. And when somebody takes that collection of stuff and does something outside the standard feature set with it, it makes you think two things. One of them is, for me at least, wow, I have done nothing with my life. But also, you know, like, that's what's there. And two, it's this encouragement, this like, this is how what happens when we try and run faster than we have, when we look over the next hill, when we, you know, try and figure out what's beyond that next rise. And the Lafitte quote is, you know, he said something like, I know that no human being can do a miracle. Nobody commands magical properties, but Gilles made you wonder. He was that quick. And the fact that those guys, and that's common to those people at that level, right? They all talk about some metaphysical, even Senna talking about how he was in the car. It was all this like, I do not know what's happening, but it's there. You know, I see the light of God. And the Enzo thing is, God, that guy was such a jerk. The Enzo thing is from his book, Pilote Che Gente, published in 1985. And the whole quote is really long. I won't bore you with the whole thing. But basically, the middle line is perfect. It's, yes, there were those who considered him nutty, but his energy combined with his daring and his destructive capacity, and then he spends like an entire sentence talking about all the things he burned up. He just lists, like, well, he blew up axle shafts and gears and clutches and brakes, and like, Enzo was a jerk. But he was he gets to the point, he says, what was required for a racer to protect himself in an unexpected situation in desperate circumstances? He was the champion warrior, blah, 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 blah. I was extremely fond of him. And this is a guy who, remember, since the middle 1950s had treated drivers as disposable, as interchangeable. You know, the scene in the Adam Driver movie is only lightly exaggerated. You know, they were basically widgets. You plug them into the car. He got attached to nobody. He was famously torn apart by his son's death. This was a dude who did not truck in emotion, and he was fond of Gilles. And the dude watched him race once and was like, yes, here, come, drive now. Yes, we do. Like, that's amazing. Like, you make a dent on that guy. It's like making a dent in a ball of titanium with your knuckle. I mean, it's nuts.
And Sam, I think you've said, you know, you make a dent. Gilles made a dent in motorsport.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't have a long Formula One career. There were races that he probably should have won that he didn't win. But there's not many who made a dent like he did.
Yeah.
I think here's a question for you, Ross and Sam. Both of you guys have a different probably take on this, but if you were to look at the statistics, you talked about the baseball, you know, box score kind of things, Sam.
Sure.
You would look at Gilles' son's Formula One career is wildly more successful than Jill's. He won the world championship, right? And you would go, well, okay, well, his son was better than him. But anybody that really knows, I don't think thinks that. And I'm not taking anything away from Jacques. I mean, he won the world championship. That's a hard thing to do. That puts him as one of the best drivers. It defined him as the best driver in the world that year and has to put him as one of the best drivers. You can't take that away from him. That's a high achievement. But I don't think there's many that would say, oh, yeah, he was better than Gilles.
Well, think about it, right? You know, Jacques won the championship and he went to IndyCar and he was good. And like, you know,
won the 8500.
Yeah, on paper, that guy is more. You're right. But people don't. And it comes down to who you are and how you look at it. And not to in any way knock Jacques, but there is something that sticks with people. And there was a different version of it in his dad. And that doesn't make either one of them better or worse. It just makes, as a human, it just makes them different. But
exactly.
I think on that note, that we're about out of time. That's our show. If you get a chance, please check out the Gerald Donaldson, Gilles Villeneuve book. It's called The Life of the Legendary Racing Driver. We consulted a bunch of different sources for this episode. That was just one of them, but it's worth your time if you got it. It talks in human terms about the guy who, more than anything, I think, defined what it means to be a racer, to keep going, to try when it makes no more sense to keep trying, and to just always be down for anything. But that is everything. Tune in next week. Our topic will be, what do we have in the sheet? It's Ross and Jeff talking about that time Ross was in high school and playing in a band that was going nowhere, and Jeff built a time machine out of a car that was kind of like a Lotus, and then they went back in time to keep Sam's parents from splitting up in high school, except it ended up taking about three times as long as anybody expected, and Jeff made the car fly for some reason, but that was okay because it was the future, and it was the Old West, and the dog was named after Dan Gurney instead of Einstein, and the end. See you next time.
Salut, Gilles.